Do you want to understand where the advertising and marketing industry is headed over the next 12 months? Then tune into our new webcast series, Reframing the Industry. We'll be joined by three special guests debating a new ecosystem map that ExchangeWire has created to help you understand what the future business model for agencies and service partners, brands and marketers, and technology suppliers looks like. Part one is happening at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, June 29, and you can register at exchangewire.com/IR webcast part one. Make sure you're part of the conversation.
The MarTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Delighted to welcome our special guest to the podcast session today, Joe Camp, Senior Media Partnerships Manager at Dentsu. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks for having me, guys. Looking forward to today.
Not at all. Our pleasure. And in the ExchangeWire hot seat today, we have Anne-Marie Sheedy, Global Partnerships Director. Hello, Anne-Marie.
Hello. Good morning.
Excellent sound quality. For listeners, we've all just been, you know, jigging around with our headsets this morning, and AMS now doesn't sound like Darth Vader, which is a result.
For the moment, anyway, who knows?
Yeah, no more echoey rooms.
Yeah, yep. Joe took us on a tour of the Dentsu office. Okie dokes, first news story of the week that I wanted to chat through with the two of you, an article in Forbes penned by Jonathan Treber outlining the move to first-party data as a result of phasing out cookie-based targeting and identifiers in a mobile environment, and that will actually be an opportunity for brands and retailers, at least that's the premise in the article. So he goes on to outline some of the things that I'm sure many listeners will be sort of eye-rolling hearing this, thinking, yeah, we always knew this. Third-party cookies were an exact science in the first place, and a lot of brands and retailers and even publishers in the industry are now asking themselves how useful third-party cookies were for targeting in the first instance. They became relied upon, I suppose, in instances where brands, retailers and some publishers didn't have first-party data, or it was very difficult for them to extract first-party data, and there was always accuracy and integrity issues with third-party cookies, as Jonathan outlines in this article, and that has sort of created a little barrier for brands and retailers to develop direct customer relationships and loyalty with their customers. So it's now clear that having those direct relationships with customers, although that's difficult and time consuming, that's much more of a sustainable way of communicating with your customers and marketing to consumers and sustaining your businesses in the long term. So the argument also outlines that publishers were in perhaps a slightly better position in the first instance to improve their first party data capabilities, either through site traffic, access logins and subscription models and services where they had those in place. But a lot of brands struggled to gather first-party data. Perhaps they had business models where their first-party data assets either were non-existent altogether or were not very obvious. And Jonathan's premise is that actually we're probably coming to a phase where those brands are understanding that there's more first-party data available than they first thought. A lot of brands and retailers have got loyalty programs, and a lot of them are capturing what we're now referring to in the industry is zero-party data, information that they're retaining from customers in a voluntary capacity. So customers giving direct access to information, again, either through loyalty schemes or signing up for various promotions and offers. So his premise is also that brands who neglected their first-party data assets and sort of focusing on building out that infrastructure are now faced with a bit of a race against time with the deprecation of cookies and identifiers, but that actually employing that hard work will be an investment for the future. So it's a really sort of nicely penned piece. It's interesting because he's writing it also very much from a sort of brand and retailer point of view. So I know we have this conversation a lot in the ad tech industry, but it's good to hear this spoken about from a retail perspective. So I'm interested in understanding whether you agree with his premise. I was also thinking as I was reading this, you know, there was a bit of a phrase rolling around for a long time in the industry, nobody ever got fired for buying Facebook, because his point of view is that perhaps brands have relied too solidly on Facebook and social media platforms, which thereby put them in a position where they weren't able to gather first-party data. So I'm particularly interested in your point of view on that. And also what you think about those businesses that are in a position where they struggled to easily get first-party data. What are some of the maybe tools and tactics that might be at their disposal to start building out that first-party data infrastructure? Joe, coming to you first on that litany of questions.
Cheers, Rachel. I've actually got to say, I had a bit of a wry smile reading this one because I think, yeah, pretty much agree with everything saying in there. Especially if I want to, you know, I really want to look at it more from like the publisher point of view, because I actually started my career on the publisher side, and my first foray into programmatic was a few years back now when I was actually working at National Rail Inquiries. And that was a really interesting point for me because, like, it depends what you look at as first party data, right? Obviously, there's logged in data, there's fully, like, you know, all personal information that's being shared in a compliant manner. But actually, I think what's really powerful is, well, you know, what you do on sites like utility sites like National Rail or any other kind of booking website, because, you know, starting to sort of understand things like ad servers and key values and everything that can be, you know, captured interactions on the site. That becomes really, really powerful data, and I think it's forgotten about a bit. And really, that is first-party data. It's not, you know, it might not be identifiable, but it's interactions, and it's the big thing about it is intent. My old boss there used to put it in a really good way and say, there's plenty more interesting things to do on the internet than look at train time. So if you're in London and you're going to Manchester, guess where you're going to be on the weekend? Guess where you're going to be? And yeah, I think, like, you know, obviously, that's just one small example, but you extrapolate that out to similar sites or, you know, similar opportunities. And I think all of a sudden now it's kind of where it was overlooked, or, okay, that's all great data. Can we just put it into a DMP? Can you just pass it over to us and we'll buy it in the open market? And it's like, well, yeah, but not all sites were set up to do that. Not all publishers had that capability. So now it's almost coming like full circle again, a bit like contextual. All of a sudden you've got power, like, publishers are back in the power seat in a way, and they can actually start demonstrating, you know, there's a lot more we can understand, ascertain, really get a feel for by on-site interactions rather than just logged in data, you know, because also as well, a lot of these sites, unfortunately, you don't get cheaper tickets, you don't get faster trains by logging in. There is a login section, but really the value is in what you do on the site. So yeah, I think it's great. And I think if it's done correctly and if it's understood correctly and deployed correctly, it could really be something that is a new way we go around buying. Obviously, I suppose to play devil's advocate, the, you know, the downside of thinking of it in that way is then you're back in a position where, well, you know, we're going to need multiple sites. There's going to be multiple sites that have all these, this rich first party data. All of a sudden that becomes a bit more of legwork for the campaign managers or buyers. And all of a sudden you send out loads of different sites. And then it's about, you know, that's the next problem to solve. And actually there's, you know, a lot of tech partners we're working with, sorry, vendors or exchanges we're working with are actually doing, you know, lots of interesting stuff in this space. I know Podmatic got their audience encore project to actually ingest the first party data that sits in the SSP rather than trying to, you know, put it out, put it in a DSP. And yeah, I think there's something really, really cool now because all of a sudden you're buying multiple sites in one deal ID and picking the kind of first party data elements you want. And then you're telling the story that way.
I think you've raised some really interesting points there, Joe. And definitely we're having a lot more conversations about the sort of, if you like, renaissance of context. And then there are a lot of experts in the industry saying that now that actually they always felt context was a better tool than third-party cookies were. And if you've got intent overlaid with some context, that actually that's bringing some really rich targeting segments forward. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that continues to develop over the coming months. And I think the other really interesting point you mentioned as well is that I don't know if this is where you're going with it, but are we therefore then creating an environment where we're setting up a lot of walled gardens within which people will, I suppose, discrete buying environments is what I would call them rather than walled gardens. Some might use the term walled gardens. And I wonder if that's going to start to become an issue, you know, for buyers as we sort of, you know, continue to traipse through this sort of world of cookie-less targeting.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I imagine it will. I think the big call out here is obviously if people are realizing or publishers are realizing the power of their own data, they've now got ownership of their own data again. They don't have to rely on, you know, the DMPs or trying to put in third party data to overlay in a deal ID when actually, no, we've got it all here. So, no one in the office to activate the automatic line.
You're going to have to
my theme to do it.
There we go.
But yeah, so there's probably going to be a big piece of ownership of that again, which, yeah, you know, in the short term, probably could get scenario where all of a sudden you've got, you know, discrete or controlled buying environments. But I think that's an easier problem to solve than the potential problem it looks like it is, if that makes sense. Like I say, you know, there's ways to, like, getting closer to the SSPs probably is the way to do it, because I think that's where it's going to be better. You aren't going to rely on several hops then from other techs into DSPs and jumping around that way. And you'd think things like match rates would be good. But yeah, look, it's a really pertinent point, because there's probably be some reluctance to share at first or to play together. But then you just look at, you look at things like the Ozone Project and what was Pangea and, these sort of alliances. Maybe it's a rise of alliances that will come out of this. And it's something we, Germany are well far ahead of that. The Ozone doing great things here. So yeah, maybe it's a rise and that happens, and it's more about publishers aligning with each other and sharing and working together rather than, trying to everyone do their own piece to battle the walled gardens, work together and make a bigger walled garden collectively.
Yeah. A lot in that. Anne-Marie, AMS.
There certainly is a lot between your opening question and what you've just covered. It's like, okay, where do I dig in? Firstly, in a way, I think it's good riddance to bad rubbish when it comes to the third-party cookie. And, tracking consumers using third-party cookie was a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, I feel. And the good thing now is that I feel that retailers, brands and publishers, they're back in the driver's seat. Like Joe said, they've got control. They can leverage their own data, and at the same time, they can start to foster more direct relationships with the customer and build that brand loyalty piece. The flip side, though, is that not everyone has their own first-party data, or if they do, they don't necessarily have a way to harness it. So there's different levels of sophistication there. When it comes to the kind of the zero-party data that you mentioned, that kind of subset of first party data, I think that's interesting. I mean, you see it more and more. I don't necessarily partake all the time, but now and again I do. It's that very, that collecting data using surveys or polls or questionnaires or preference centers, and that information is given freely and consensually by customers, consumers, whatever, depending on the environment that they're in. And with that understanding that it's going to be used to personalize the experience. So I'm going to get a better experience. So therefore, I'm happy to have that kind of value exchange. If you stop sending me the wrong information, or in our colleagues, Lindsay's experience when she gets sent information about tractors. Never.
Yeah, it's a nice exchange, isn't it? I think you're really right there. I mean, I think you ask most people, they just, would love to see things relevant to them. And, for the most part, I think it's more and more common knowledge now that the internet is free because of advertising. So why not make it work for you?
But that's a really good point, Joe. It's more and more common knowledge. But I feel that at times we're in a bubble. Our understanding, our awareness of what's going on is vastly different from Joe Bloggs, who might just log on to the Daily Mail to check something, or, the Sun Sport or whatever. They've got no idea what they've been doing, what information they've been sharing. And now I feel that brands and retailers have kind of begun directly asking us for insight into, our needs. What do we want? What are our interests? What's our intent? And if it's open and transparent, that word that we love to use, but don't necessarily action all the time, I think that's a much better way going forward.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. I'm going to move us on to second news story, which is that Netflix have launched their own e-com store selling merchandise relating to their Netflix original shows. Now, this is at the moment only available in the US, launched in the US, but they're planning to roll it out into global markets in the coming months. They're intending to sell exclusive limited edition apparel and lifestyle products. And they've developed their online store in part and launched it in partnership with Shopify. So, therefore providing the infrastructure for them. This, to me, feels like something that was almost inevitable, because they've also got licensing deals for various Netflix-related products that they sell in-store. So, Walmart, Target, H&M, Amazon, etc. And so it feels like an extrapolation of that to me. And also it feels like something that they may well have had to do in order to keep pace with their competitors. You know, we know that the likes of NBC Universal have got in-program shopping offering. And, you know, the first thing I thought of when I read this article was Disney. Like, if you've got a strong brand, then it's just an it's just an obvious merch opportunity, right? But I guess the other element of this is how much of this is a sort of longer-term business strategy. We know that the Netflix business model still heavily relies on subscription first. They've been very, very vocal ever since their inception that they would never rely on advertising revenue. So this is clearly another sort of string to their bow. But I'm wondering from a strategic perspective how much they're going to need to rely on this. So what's your view on this? Do you think it was inevitable? And do you think it will keep them competitive with their peers on the sort of TV streaming side of the industry? Anne-Marie, what do you think?
I do think it's inevitable. I think it's just the beginning. There's going to be Netflix land. There's going to be Netflix, Netcoin. It's not going to stop. And I don't see why it would. Going back to what we were talking about in terms of the value exchange and the experience, I love Netflix. I love the algorithms behind, you know, what I watch and the recommendations. Most of the time, they're pretty spot on. If it's easy for me to shop on there, if I was a, you know, Stranger Things fan and I wanted the t-shirts and stuff and I was like, oh, I'm really excited and I get exclusive access and I can press a button and buy it there, absolutely no problem. Netflix land is probably a bit further off, but I'm curious to know if they do go into kind of cryptocurrency or some sort of online value there, because I see a world where I would probably exchange watching a couple of ads for some Netcoin if I could trade that then to buy something, or I could send a friend a film to watch or a series. And I think they'd go for that because then you're starting to get those non-subscribers engaged and involved. And that's another hook, and that's more first-party data because they'll have to log in. And I just think it can go on and on and on. The big question is how they're going to manage it. Like anything else, like fraud, that's going to be tricky. But I think it's the opportunities are unlimited.
I mean, Netflix land. I want that to happen, actually. Can you imagine?
What would be the first ride you'd go on?
Oh, some Strange Things crack that takes you into the, what's it called, the Upside Down. Oh, my God, what a great idea. I hope someone from Netflix is listening to this. Excellent.
Of course they are.
It'd be good if the queuing system was all based on like how quick your connection is. So, you know, there's no buffering and there's no delay to actually queuing. But if you get it on a bad day, then it could be hours and hours.
Oh, but then you'd probably have to play a game because that's the other area they're going to go into, right?
Gaming. Yeah, gaming, of course.
Or free, or listen to a podcast while you wait.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you can always buy something if it rains. You know, you can buy your Netflix umbrella that would probably be delivered by drone.
Yeah.
I'm loving this new world. Joe, what did you think of this story?
Yeah, I think, really interesting, actually. It's almost, after reading it, you think, God, yeah, it's surprised it didn't happen sooner. But I think there was almost, it's an odd one because where they're really, you know, the established, really the people that came in disrupted the rental area or the home viewing space. And back then it was, you know, licensing content or like, you know, paying for the rights of TV shows, films. And, you know, the originals that came a bit later. So I suppose when you compare to, I know then Disney's, the Fox, NBC's and all these other now streaming giants where they're now caught up to Netflix, they've had original content. They've had merchandisable properties and characters and really had that brand affinity for so, so long. It's like, you know, kind of going opposite ends. So, it's obviously massively inevitable. And yeah, it's time for them to start capitalizing because they have got, you know, Stranger Things, The Witcher, the first two that pop to mind, ones that are probably merchandisable given, you know, their popularity, especially in like, you know, that Comic-Con sort of space where, you know, you see how big those events are and how much people are willing to pay to, you know, to have a piece of something they're really, really into. So, yeah, I think it's, and obviously the need to diversify as well. You know, they're not the only fish in the pond now. So, you know, a world where you can I suppose if you've got kids that are really into, or teenagers watching Stranger Things, and you accidentally pause it while you're going, you know, refreshing up your cup of tea, and all of a sudden there's an API in to buy the models or to buy the t-shirts while paused, a bit like what Amazon do with the IMDb integration. But they've already got your details, they've already got your, you know, your payment details, and know your address. So it's basically they're doing the direct to consumer piece that so many other brands are doing now. And I think it's, yeah, really, really interesting. Something else in the article that sort of stood out to me and I thought was cool as well was mention about the sort of like the Netflix logo or the Netflix merchandise, but actually based around the brand rather than the individual properties. And they're in conjunction with the Japanese fashion house Beams. Now, Beams is like quite a high-end sort of streetwear brand, lives in that world. It's a bit like, you know, like Supremes, Palaces, things like that. And these are the stuff you get fanboys queuing up for days and days, or, you know, really, really making a beeline to go and get the exclusive drops and things like that. So, you know, they constantly collaborate with other brands, and lots of collaboration you never see coming. So that's quite interesting as well, because all of a sudden maybe there's limited edition high-end street fashion that's Netflix you know, collaborate with. All of a sudden you've got that kind of that exclusivity piece and that really desire from maybe some of their younger users. So yeah, I don't think it's too little too late at all. I think it's just they've been looking at how to do it best. Yeah, learning from their competitors perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess that's in keeping with the Netflix brand and the way that they have always articulated their business model, which is, you know, they've always very much tried to go for that sort of accessible but premium, that premium look and feel and that premium kind of proposition, but with an accessible price tag. So yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how they continue to build this from a brand point of view, because actually prior to talking and getting the you know, perspective from the two of you, it's only when I was hearing you, you know, share your views there, I started to think of it, especially Netflix world, but even you know, your opinion there, Joe, on the collaboration with the Japanese fashion house, I started to think of it from more of a brand perspective. And I don't know if I'd want things that are necessarily Netflix branded, but I definitely love their original content. So it'll just be interesting to see how they try and marry those things together and how they try to, you know, bring customers with that concept.
I think that would be interesting. I mean, I understand where you're coming from, Rachel, but then if you think about the various demographics that are engaging with the brand and what they want versus what you want, and they've got that insight and they've got that understanding, they know what their habits are, they know what their behaviors, what time they're watching stuff, what they're watching, and they'll use that insight. And that's where they'll be able to create all these partnerships, the collaboration. You know, I can't imagine you queuing in, you know, for a skateboard shop in the back street of Soho for a drop of some pair of trainers that I don't even know the name of.
Don't know me very well, do you?
I know, massive assumptions there.
But I think you made a really good point, Anne-Marie, actually, about you know, would you consider watching a few ads to get some value back from Netflix, be that in coin or tickets to Netflix Land or whatever that may be. And I think
maybe Netland. Should we go with Netland?
Yeah, Netflix Netland. Land just sort of is a bit
too much.
Yeah,
it's too long. Too
Netland,
long.
Lazy the Netcoin. These days.
Use your Netcoins to get into Netland.
Yeah.
But like I remember sort of thinking a little bit, you know, the growth of CTV, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, but almost thinking like, all right, well, what can Netflix do to kind of keep up? Do they make a subsidized model when actually, you know what, I'll pay half my price now if I have to watch an ad ever again, or, you know, maybe I can access an hour free content by having a free view model by watching some ads. And I think that's a really point. And you know, you're right, they always made a point that no, we'll never be ads, there'll never be ad funded, there'll never be ad breaks in it. So whether or not they thought, well, that was something we may have to look at to remain competitive, but then, you know, if these kind of developments can alleviate those pressures, then obviously they can stick to their core messaging or their core, you know, business model from the outset and actually just drive revenue in other places. And the weird thing is, I think people are so used to seeing merch, so people are so used to seeing the add-ons now. I don't think people could be fooled a little bit to thinking, oh, you know, they're not really advertising to me, I'm still just getting pure content, but really you're just being enticed to spend more in other pockets.
That's true. Definitely. But I wonder what it's like in other markets. I wonder, you know, when they're entering other markets, what the model is, because they're not going to be able to charge $9.99 or whatever it is now in certain places. So there's probably a different model that we're just maybe not aware of. I don't know.
Yeah, very true.
And then that also makes me think about what their merch model in those markets are like too. If we're talking about exclusive, sort of merchandise, apparel or lifestyle items, whatever those might be. When anyone says lifestyle, I'm thinking like candles. Can't imagine Netflix original programming candles, but I guess you never know. Will they be able to make that stack up in different marketplaces? Because those, the price points for entry into those markets is vastly different in different regions. So it'll be really interesting to see how that unfolds. Anyway, all I can say is whoever from Netflix is listening to this, we're trademarking that business model.
And Netflix lands.
Definitely. Netland, remember, Joe.
Netland, right. Sorry, yeah.
Okay, moving us on to the third story of the week. An Ad Exchange article reporting that advertising budgets aren't keeping pace with the rate of increased consumption of streamed and internet-connected TV content. So Roku recently reported that in the US, 50% of viewing time amongst 18 to 34-year-olds is streamed content. But anecdotally, the proportion of advertising budgets spent in this channel is as little as 10%. So we've been talking about this, I feel like, for a couple of years. When will advertising and marketing budgets shift from traditional TV and linear budgets into digital and connected TV? But this article goes a bit further as to why there might be a bit of a slow move from brands and marketers to be doing that. The argument is that traditional agencies are stifling innovation because they benefit economically by selling traditional TV placements, so they're not incentivized to encourage brands and marketers to shift their spend. But the article also points to there being still a distinct separation between linear and traditional budgets and then digital budgets, and how that's doing is keeping the sort of skills and expertise separated as well. So agencies that specialize in traditional TV advertising have got that economic incentive that I mentioned, but those digital agencies that specialise in CTV don't necessarily have the relationships with the top TV channels and the top TV advertising buyers to create the best deals. So the argument is there needs to be more alignment between those capabilities within agencies and across agencies, whether they're traditional agencies or smaller agencies, to start to see some collaboration. But ultimately, the article suggests that these challenges, added to which are things like the complexity of the CTV ecosystem at the moment, measurement metrics and understanding those, how brands and marketers get to grips with understanding the value of the budgets that they're putting into that channel. But that none of this is really going to shift until brands and marketers are pushing and effectively demanding that their budgets shift to those digital channels. So I'm really interested to know whether you agree with the premise here that traditional agencies are in part responsible for holding back budgets moving into connected TV channels. I'm particularly interested in your point of view on that, Joe. And whether brands and marketers maybe aren't demanding enough of their agency partners, just in terms of maybe even experimentation and innovation to try to test budgets in CTV. We know that, viewers and eyeballs are shifting very rapidly. So it does feel like there will come a crunch point where whether brands and marketers feel confident about it or not, they will just want to naturally shove more spend into these channels. And I guess my question is, to what extent is the industry prepared and ready for that? I know on the technology side, we've been talking a lot about the ad tech capabilities around connected TV. And I guess I'm also interested in any points of view that either of you might have on those sort of, fundamental challenges that keep being brought up every time we talk about whether connected TV really will expand and grow, in the coming 12 months. And that is that brands and marketers are still getting to grips with things like measurement, brand safety, those sorts of issues. Joe, over to you first.
Yeah, it's a really hot topic. I think CTV in general, BVODs, the move to CTV, the growth of it. I'd probably say I kind of agree and both disagree with like the points made in the article, because I feel although like the points, very clear, the move over to CTV is probably not happening investment wise as quick as the rate it's growing at. Seems similar to the app space a good few years ago, but I kind of feel like it's almost suggesting that the big holding co's like Dentsu are not doing enough or not really championing it. And from my point of view, I don't think that's correct. Maybe it's a bit disingenuous. I work in a programmatic team. we are, a lot of our clients are programmatic first, and a lot of them are quite savvy and own their own tech. So they're very aware of, you know, the CTV space, while they might not understand it that much. So it's probably easy for me to say that actually, you know, CTV is a bit more of a thing than people might think it is, and maybe something like the other teams. But yeah, the truth is definitely there in terms of like what we've had to itself. I think back in 2019, we started really testing it and dipping our toes in quite a lot, both working with broadcasters or CTV publishers or apps directly, then moving over to doing buys across exchanges, just for CTV space. And yeah, we sort of saw some really, really interesting results. I mean, you're right, the measurement piece isn't quite there. The insights piece, the data piece isn't quite there, which I think is that's what becomes a stumbling block for clients. I think that's where the disconnect is, because again, probably, you know, two-edged sword, being a programmatic team and championing things like addressability, targeting, measurements, brand safety, have been able to read all that when we're running in environments and online, be that, you know, video display. And we can report that back to clients, or with clients that own their own tech that we use, you know, they can see that all day long. And all of a sudden you say, hey, look, oh, great news, you can now buy TV programmatically. It's like CTV is here. Like, you can expand into a big screen. It's, you know, many eyeballs on one impression rather than a one-to-one environment. And I think there's a whole thing in like, okay, great, cool, we'll run us some of those campaigns and, you know, let's measure it, let's see what the results are. And you're like, oh, one point on that, we can't, it's not a space that can do that yet. We can tell you about how many impressions ran and the channels it went on, but we can't actually give you any more measurements. So I think that's where all of a sudden, you know, you've got people that are so in their mind of like, oh, programmatic is, you know, so open, I can do everything, I can see everything. Like, oh, hang on a minute, no, I can't do any of this. I might as well come in buying linear TV. But then you've got to kind of, you know, think about, well, actually, a bit like we talked about cookies earlier, like the GRP rating systems of buying linear, you know, how much of an exact science is that really? And actually, if we are, you know, when the space starts slowly catching up with terms of measurement and targeting capabilities, which I'm sure it will get to, or I hope so anyway, then all of a sudden it becomes a bit more of a powerful thing to start putting internally. But yeah, and I suppose the other reason, maybe on a more economical scale, is why, you know, it hasn't really moved over from the AV teams or, you know, the traditional TV budgets, is precisely that, you know, the big companies, the big holding companies are siloed in many ways. And all of a sudden you've got people saying, well, actually, can you not just take CTV tests out of your own digital budget? When really, you know, our initiative is saying, no, this should come out of the AV budgets. This should be incremental to what we're offering programmatically. So, no, why don't we sort of collaborate, or why don't you pass over some of your AV budget? And all of a sudden you start getting some really tricky conversations internally, and nobody, you know, rightfully so, nobody wants to give up their budgets or their work that they do. And I think the only way to really sort of scale it massively is to realize that you got to take budgets from the channels rather than just try and make CTV or any other emerging channels work in the existing digital budgets.
Mm. And do you think that others are coming to that way of thinking as well, Joe? Like, is that dilemma being settled in holding groups? Because you must have been having these conversations for a couple of years now at this stage.
Yeah. Again, I think it's dependent on a case-by-case basis. Like I said, I keep using sort of examples of like our clients who own their own tech, who are very tech savvy. They kind of, you know, they saw no problem with it straight away. When we, you know, sold it in as like a new channel, you know, very aware of like, want to be testing what's new and what's around. And yeah, they're happy to do so. And then we actually, you know, through some good work with the account managers and the campaign managers, actually, first of all, you know, sending it in, making the campaigns work and deliver. Because yeah, the tech integrations aren't all completely there, especially when you're dependent on, most of your clients are dependent on DV360, and it just wasn't really the way to run CTV at first. But yeah, and then, you know, there's a piece of consolidation as well, isn't there, when it comes to that? Again, talking from my own experience at Dentsu, but being programmatic team, our clients are, you know, trying to consolidate into programmatic where possible, or, you know, where necessary. So all of a sudden, I feel like it's going to come, push going to come to shove at some point. Maybe brands, you're right, maybe they're not asking enough yet, maybe they're not demanding enough yet, agencies, but say, no, if it can be bought programmatic, it should be bought programmatic. So therefore, we want to be running CTV. And then there's a disconnect as well, isn't it, between BVOD and CTV. So BVOD, I think, very much does still massively live in the AV channels, because it's just a different way of buying linear TV in many ways, even though a lot of it does appear on catch-up. So, yeah, it's an education piece, I think, it all boils down to with a lot of these emerging channels. And, like, you know, almost a victim of its own success in a way. It grew so dramatically, and you know, not just during a pandemic, but the whole, you know, swath of like cord nevers, cord cutters is only growing and growing and growing. And I feel like maybe as a industry, we probably wasn't expecting it to blow up that much. And so now we're playing catch up, which again puts brands and advertisers a little bit in the back foot as well, perhaps.
Yeah. Interesting. Anne-Marie.
I was pleased you went to Joe first on that one. I thought this is a bit harsh. I agree with Joe. I think, you know, agree and disagree with some of what has been said with regards to the brands and needing to push more. Yes, that's always the case. I think agencies get a bit of bad press. I think they're doing what they can. And like you said, you've got different clients with different skill sets, different tech stacks, different appetites. But I also feel that perhaps there could maybe be more done within the agency. It's still very silo operated. You know, you're in the programmatic team. What about, you know, are the planners going to have the holy grail from now on because they're just looking at everything? Ultimately, it's like, what will give us the best results for our clients? We shouldn't be scrapping over which budget it is, which line item it is. It's just about putting together an omni-channel campaign that gets them the right results. But then when you talk about results, the measurement piece, Joe, that you were talking about, that's really tricky because it's been the barrier, I think, to connected TV adoption. And it's going to continue to be that way. And we might, because there's no centralized or standardization across the various pieces. So that's probably going to continue to cause challenges. And maybe from there, you're going to have the birth of more and more walled gardens or meta gardens within that. Because if I want a measurement piece that I understand, or going back to what we're talking about, the cookie, that was a load of BS, really, in a way. It was self-prophesizing what people wanted to hear. What did it really mean? Oh, you've got this and it means this and it means that because we're telling you so. How are we going to get to a place where there's genuine understanding and there isn't this kind of lack of universal measurement causing problems? People will just go and buy what they want. If they see the results, then they'll continue buying. I will go to Channel 4 because they have a third of the UK population logged in. I know exactly what they're doing. I know their demographic. I know how what results I will get, and it'll just build from there. But how long it'll take, I don't know. I really find these stats very interesting. Yes, it's kind of the past 12, 15 months as it continues to go on, expedited it in a way. But all the stats you're seeing, oh yeah, so a 33.9% increase in connected television consumption in the US. Yes, of course it's gone up because nobody could do anything else. Mm. You know, will that habit continue? That's what's going to be interesting. But also to your point, Joe, yes, the cord cutters and the change of behavior. And what, you need to do something 28 times or something to change your behavior. We've done that. We've done it more than that. So our behaviors have changed and they'll continue. But how do you keep up? And that measurement piece and that kind of integration across the agency world is going to be tricky. But I think that'll just change rapidly as well.
Yeah. And I think, like you mentioned as well, Rachel, about like how fragmented the space is, the environment is. And yeah, you couldn't be more right. And I think that's what causes issues, but that's what makes it harder or more challenging to set in and to ultimately understand. Because all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about, if you're talking just CTV environments, you know, you're talking this new generation of online TV apps, so lots of free content, and actually the quality of the content there is getting better and better. It's no longer just, you know, like long tail stuff. But then all of a sudden, you know, again, great for us being an international team, we've tried to be tested CTV in, you know, UK, most of Europe, America and Canada, and yeah, it's slightly different everywhere. You know, you're looking at France, you're buying IPTV, so you're actually buying linear in some cases, or at least catch up, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, hang on a minute, but that's very different to, you know, and what you're putting on the plan, which is just, you know, Zumo and Pluto's and these CTV publishers in the UK. Why is that different to our French plan when we've got M6 and TF1? These are big quality broadcasters. Same over in the US. I think, you know, there's a bit more data you can lay on how long that will be a thing for, because obviously with the America's sort of moving towards similar scenarios like GDPR, so that may be shifting a bit. But yeah, it's so fragmented, and it's so hard to even like simplify it. We probably got about 6 or 7 working decks just in our team alone, just from the people that know a lot about CTV, and we can go really granular and talk about the best ways to set it up, the best DSPs, the best routes of access to, you know, short form decks. And we just, you know, to do it to clients that don't really, aren't really aware of the space. And all of a sudden, to try and get all that into a short form deck to really easily explain the nuances in the space just starts, you go down a bit of a rabbit hole. But, and unfortunately, because it is something that's so, it's not a billboard or a MPU or a pre-roll or an outstream, which is, you know, universal. It's broadcasting, and the way we consume TV is so different, wildly different in every single continent, in every single country, or the other way around, sorry, every single country and every single continent, that it's, you know, you just don't think there's ever going to be a unified way it's delivered and consumed. So maybe it's just something, you know, you just got to grin and bear it and just find the best, just get used to it and understand it so much that it becomes second nature.
And I wonder as well, though, because, yeah, I mean, that's a really good sort of rundown of all of the challenges, basically. But I also wonder if we're going to be, as an industry, so not just from the push won't just come from brands and marketers, but it will also come sort of across the industry. I wonder if we're all going to be forced to face some of these challenges a bit more head on and to be really sort of thrust into the world of CTV and buying in that environment and what that looks like, because it is, you know, it's a cookie-less environment, right? So it's somewhere that hasn't, it's an environment that hasn't had to deal with those challenges, deprecation of IDs and cookie-based targeting. So you can imagine a lot of buyers thinking, okay, what I'm now no longer able to do in a different environment, let me think about trying to move some budget over to connected TV and experiment with that. So we might all be sort of forced to get a bit more comfortable with this kind of slightly fragmented world. So I wonder if that's going to happen, first thing. And the second thing, just listening to you talk there, Joe, is I also then think we're probably never going to come to a place where there's some sense of uniformity from a global point of view, because those TV markets, whether they're traditional or digital first or whatever, are just so different in every region, because people have got slightly different viewing habits, slightly different lifestyles, and also too because content providers, what we would refer to in a TV world as broadcasters and content owners, operate differently. I mean, I guess it's possible that, you know, in a more digitized version of that, our behavior and the way that we consume things and therefore the way that content is delivered to us becomes more uniform over time. But I still think we're going to have, you know, quite significant differences from market to market, which means that you're going to be executing things differently. You're going to be using technology in a different way. That's going to be operating in a different way. There will be some fundamentals, and you've mentioned one of them, Joe, which is that privacy compliance will start to become a global thing too, but that's still going to look different in different markets. So I don't know how do you get to grips with all of that. I guess it's and that sort of brings me back to my first point, which is it's something I think we're going to find as an industry we're just doing more and more and more of, and that's going to grow exponentially in the next 12 to 18 months because it is a privacy-first environment.
I think that's where the brands need to give the agencies a bit of a break and realise the work and effort and the skill set that goes behind all this information, the various decks, and stop squeezing margins and driving down price, and understand that they're paying for not just the execution, but the knowledge behind that, that kind of global expertise, global knowledge at a local level. That's, yeah. I think, you know, is a starting point.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you're right with that. You know, I think paying for the knowledge, the expertise, you know, you could go on about it all day. You could dig further and further down a rabbit hole, try and really understand all the offshoots of the way the system is, the space is. But ultimately, you know, if you're the brand and the advertising employing agency to do a job, you don't have to know all that. You don't have to worry yourself too much, and you know, rely on your agencies, rely on your, you know, your account managers, account directors, and everything like that. And yeah, like, you know, I think that's the way, you know, the way we're trying to approach it. I mean one of the ways we kind of simplified it is, you know, position it as it's a contextual buy in many ways at the moment, which, so, you know, very pertinent at the minute, coming back round full circle to, you know, the return of context is king. But yeah, and that's the way we've constructed all of our CTV buys. And and again, you know, kind of getting ahead of the issues around fraud or brand safety in CTV. We've only ever bought it on PMP or PG basis, so it's like a direct one-to-one connection. I don't think it's, you know, I remember seeing a White Ops piece published probably this around this time last year around the open market space with CTV, like, you know, massively susceptible to fraud. But if you're buying it on a one-on-one basis through the trusted exchanges or directly with the publisher, you know, you alleviate that. So I've got no really qualms about that. But I think it's just, you know, position as a contextual play, which what it is in a minute. The good thing about all the channels, be they be the VOD, the linear, or, you know, the new CTV sort of channels and apps, is, you know, the metadata is there on the publisher side to actually understand what the content is. You've got things like ACR, the automatic content recognition, which can actually understand what's being shown on the screen, what's behind the glass, and all of a sudden it'd be like, okay, well, this is heavily sports, you know, content. So I know we're going in the very simplest versions of context, but, you know, bucket that in a sports package, and I think that's, you know, that's the way you've got to do it for now. It's too big to ignore. There's no point waiting for the industry to catch up with it. The only thing is, it's probably going to get to a case where it gets better. There's more you can do, that measurement targeting piece, but, you know, you don't want to be late to the party and all of a sudden, like, you know, then you've got the issues of, oh, well, how's the best way to trade it? What are the best DSPs? Oh, God, we've got to troubleshoot this now. Where you can say, well, look, we know how to buy it. We know the best ways to make it headache free. But now we're just getting more laser focused with the way we deliver it or the way we actually target it. So, yeah, it's definitely not going anywhere. I'm really keen on the space. And I think we've just got to try and work with it for now. And we'll reap the benefits when it gets a bit more grown up, mature.
Sophisticated, yeah.
Yeah.
That brings us nicely into part two of the podcast, Joe, which is a bit more of a focus on what you're working on at the moment at Dentsu. So tell us about that. At the risk of putting words into your mouth, I'm sure I'm not going to be, but I imagine that a big chunk of your time, well, not a big chunk of your time, but a proportion of your time is spent perhaps dealing with, you already mentioned that you work with a lot of tech-savvy clients, a lot of clients who've got some in-house capabilities and so forth. But I'm particularly interested to know how the conversation about advertising and personalized marketing beyond cookies and identifiers, particularly in a mobile environment, might be going with some of your clients. But, you know, say something about that and tell me what else you're thinking about on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, but when you briefed me on that earlier, I was just trying to think, wow, what amazing things, what world-breaking things can we talk about that we're working on? But, you know, the risk of sounding boring, which actually, no, it's not boring at all, is context has been a big part of what we're thinking about, what we're looking at lately. And yeah, just for the reasons you said, Rachel, we've a couple of clients are tech savvy, they know the space, and they understand that actually, you know, what we want is in market audiences. We're trying to sell products. That's what third-party cookies were created for, and obviously they're not going to be a thing so much anymore. And maybe that's kind of thing, well, actually, how valuable, how good were they anyway? So we've tried to get ahead of the, you know, the cookie apocalypse, sort of back end of last year, starting to look at context more as a proxy, both as, you know, when you've got contextual solutions where it's actually a format or a network buy that are using context as the way to power the targeting, or spaces, I suppose what I would call more like contextual data partners or contextual data vendors, where we can actually take contextual signals that have been segmented up and then buy in the open market. So that we've been looking a lot into that lately, and yeah, like that's what makes me sad about coming full circle back to context, because it's so much more superpower than it ever was. It's no longer like, okay, you want sports? Here's all the sports channels of news websites. You know, now actually, a lot of the, I think Beamray are one that come to mind, because actually, you know, they're more about looking at the signals, looking at context in what it really is, the time of day, the signals, the external factors, the sites they're on, and actually trying to find the right environment at the right place at the right time. So actually, it doesn't mean, you know, just because you're trying to find a sports audience doesn't mean you have to be on all the sports sites. There's probably, well, there definitely is so much more rich content and targetable capabilities on other sites, and really opens up your horizon a bit more. And yeah, we've done some testers, a lot of tests here and there with both, you know, one and the other, and results have been really, really strong in terms of, you know, core performance metrics, you know, the CTRs, viewabilities, things like that, which I know aren't the best proxy for success, but it's certainly, those things are all looking good. So then when you combine that with brand lift studies, which I know a lot of partners and vendors are offering up now for varying levels of minimum spend, that really starts helping paint the picture. So context is definitely something we're doing, and I think that's how we're sort of alleviating the worries or the concerns or the pressures of clients, and actually still saying, look, you can still be addressable, but maybe not in that identifying way or down to a one-on-one way, but actually, you know, how how one-on-one do you really want to go? Do you not, is it not better to be in the environment and be trending? Because that's another thing you can do with context now, is actually be around trending pieces. Anything that's new and published and hits the bid stream, and it's, you know, about the latest fad or latest trend, and, you know, you've got clients, oh yeah, I want to be all around that. Well, actually, we can do that in real time. We don't have to just update our site list or get the publisher to add new sections in. This can all be done so much more efficiently. And I think it's really starting to show that it can be and that it is.
So that's really interesting. I mean, you said that obviously from a results point of view, you know, the tests that you've been doing have been outperforming on fundamental metrics. But what about sort of, you know, bigger, wider metrics that clients might have in place? Do you feel that clients are really starting to see the success of contextual, or is it still too early in the journey? What's, you know, are you having some clients walk away going, yep, this is certainly as good as what we were doing before, if not better?
I'd like to say that. Yeah, I'd like to say definitely the piece of that. Like, cause you're right. That's why I keep coming back to like the brand lift studies, and now all of a sudden why so many willing to you know, offer them up. And actually, you know, you've got an expansion of, it's not just the Nielsen or the Millward Bounds that they're doing it now, and you have to spend 100-150k a campaign to unlock that. Really, it's you know, there's better, cheaper options out there which are either panel based or they're, you know, like live campaign based. A lot of the vendors we work with are actually developed their own in-house tools to be addressable and actually work out, you know, develop brand and studies from there. And that's a really powerful tool in finding those metrics. You know, we've got objectives from clients, they want to drive preference. And it's like, how do you even measure preference? How do you even measure that as an outcome? And the only way you can really is by using additional tools like the branded studies. And because a lot of the branded studies work we're doing is based a lot with our contextual based partners, I think that story is really starting to be told and actually to be seen. Yeah, I mean, you know, probably a small sample size for the moment. It's all been positive so far. But yeah, I think, you know, the understandings and the true benefits of it there'll be more to see. But I'd say that certainly I think it's at least as good as what everyone is doing and people are doing now. It's definitely not worse. So yeah, I think that's just going to be more and more to explore. And I say, you know, when the first party piece comes in as well and all that grows out, then what you said earlier, Amrit, you've got a mixture of context and first party, and all of a sudden that becomes something really, really powerful.
It's exciting times, really. You know, I kind of think we've said this before, but, you know, the sort of the disappearance of cookie targeting is more of an opportunity than it is a threat. And it will be really interesting to see how the industry unfolds from here.
Yeah, after the first initial few day panics, I think everybody went into, and certainly on the publisher side. But yeah, you know, you let the dust settle and you realize, oh yeah, it's always an opportunity, right? Everything's all the challenges are out there. There's someone much smarter than me somewhere already developing and coding something to actually tackle the solution.
Yep. Well, and you know, at the end of the day, we've always got Netcoin and Netland to fall back on. That is our plan B business model. Thanks so much, Joe, for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
A pleasure to have you involved. Thanks very much, Anne-Marie, for your insight. Always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. And thanks, everybody, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.